Hey everyone, welcome back. Thanks for tuning in to the second hour here. We're talking with Anthony Peak about a life of Philip K. Dick, the man who remembered the future, the new book about the fascinating author. And we were talking a little bit of in the break here, Anthony. Later we're going to get into talking more about Valis, you know. But there's something that happens here. I wanted to just clarify that a little bit in terms of the experiences that some of the people that have this kind of, in a way it's a lifestyle, but it's an insight into the world beyond, if you will. And it seems to be that it's almost overwhelming for these people when they have these experiences. In some cases, as in the case of Philip, there is drugs involved. There's very much, it's a kind of a chaotic process, if you will. But at the same time, it gives them this incredible insight into, you know, future events, things down the road and everything else. And it seems to be this always seems to be the fact of how things turn out for these kinds of people. And it's very difficult to get some kind of, stability and really trying to pin things down. Now, do you attribute that to the fact that it's part of a side effect of the doors of perception to be broken down when you have the barrier between the two, sides of the brain, what have you, that you have everything becomes much, much more lucid, I guess, to a certain extent, right? And it seems to be very difficult to structure the experiences in a coherent way. Or am I wrong there, do you think?
No, absolutely. I think that the term lucid, I think, is probably the best way of describing it. I suppose in my books, I've had a theme through them is about this idea of how we perceive reality. And how, given certain circumstances, we're given access to alternate realities. Now, of course, individuals that do very, very deep meditation will know that you can access these areas without the use of external drugs. In fact, I would argue that by certain techniques, you can access this information. I'm recalling, for instance, the technique known as Kakara Mudra, whereby by placing your tongue at the back of your throat when you've been involved in particularly deep meditation, you can sometimes have this very, very peculiar taste, which is a technique. And this technique has been used for many, many centuries. And effectively, I suggest in the Infinite Mind Field that what this is in fact vestiges of endogenous, that is internally generated dimethyltryptamine, dripping down from the pineal gland, which we'll touch on later, back into the back of the throat, and you taste it. And it's basically your own endogenous, your own internally generated ayahuasca, because they have discovered, funnily enough, I'd only found this out recently, that they have discovered that the brain has its own MAO inhibitor. That is the substance that actually allows dimethyltryptamine to become active. The brain generates, it's called harmaline. So in fact, the brain has harmaline in it, which is an MAO, stops the MAO, stopping the effects of the entheogen, as we like to call it, to find the God within. But touching about this wider perception idea, in my books, I discuss what I call the scale of transcendence. And in simple terms, what I believe is that there is a continuum, really, of perception from what we would call normal, and I'm using the term normal just because it's the statistical normality, because right, more people are normal than not. But effectively, most normal people do not really access the numinous, what Buck called cosmic consciousness, the sea of information that's out there, what Irvin Laszlo and I, you know, tend to call the zero point field, the information field, the Akashic record, that ordinarily is denied to us. But during certain neurological states, we can begin to access this information. The doors of perception become slightly ajar. And I can speak from personal experience here, because I think the first area where they become ajar is people who experience classical migraine. And as a classical migrainer myself, I know that when you are in the pre-headache aura state, what you perceive and reality starts to look very, very shaky. and what you think is real and what you're not sure about suddenly becomes quite strange. But again, somebody on Facebook today asked me the question. Oh, it was on Facebook. I think it was on Facebook. No, it was on my forum, and was saying the way in which he feels like his head's expanding before he has a migraine.
Yeah.
Now, this is actually a known phenomenon. It's actually called Alice in Wonderland syndrome, because, of course, Lewis Carroll, Dodgson, the guy who wrote Alice in Wonderland, suffered from classic migraine. And we have the section where Alice starts to get bigger and bigger and bigger and starts to shrink in that. And that's exactly what she people describe. And I have that sensation as well. And interestingly enough, Philip K. Dick had that sensation when he was a child. And again, he describes it in great detail in sections of his books, you know, where he just has this feeling of shrinking, or as he termed it, was like looking down the wrong end of a telescope. Sometimes he would find that the floor would shake and wobble. This is, again, classic pre-migraine. And again, in the book, I link up Phil, and I argue that Phil actually was a classic migrainer. And I suspect that the migraine got worse as he had these transitory ischemic attacks in his brain, these tiny little strokes that were taking place that eventually killed him. Interestingly enough, physicians sometimes find it quite difficult to differentiate between transitory ischemic attacks and migraine. And that's because the effects are very, very similar. So migraine starts the doors open. What then happens is the doors get wider when you start to experience either bipolar or temporal lobe epilepsy, in which case your access to the reality behind the reality becomes even stranger. And again, my friends who experience temporal lobe epilepsy will be dancing up and down saying, yeah, absolutely spot on,
yeah.
Because I've had literally letters from hundreds of temporal lobe epileptics from around the world who've actually told me that what I write about is exactly what they experience. They perceive reality differently. And then you get schizophrenia. And schizophrenia is where the doors of perception are so wide open that you're being bombarded by the reality as it really is, and your brain just can't deal with it. Your daemon can, because your daemon exists within that world, but your eidolon does not have the emotional, the intellectual capacity, or even the physiological abilities to process the information that is actually coming in.
Why is that? I mean, sorry to interrupt, but it's so fascinating in that regard of that it seems that our brain then, or even the life that we live, is basically just a filtering of an experience to very much limit it to something that we can understand, to make it process it in that way. But why is that? And why is the precursor to like these, you know, painful experiences also kind of on the borderline of this other world, if you will? Is it all, can we attribute it to chemicals alone that upsets in the brain and everything, and that's what kind of leads us down that path? Or why is that? Yeah.
Well, I argue that I'm a non-dualist, so therefore, as far as I'm concerned, the chemicals in the brain and the perceiver of the chemicals in the brain are all elements of the same ground state. So in other words, the chemicals are no more physical than we are, but the chemicals in some way facilitate these things.
Right.
Now, for instance, I know in my last interview I mentioned that they have now finally discovered dimethyltryptamine in the brains of live rats.
That's right, yeah.
You know, so in which case we now know that dimethyltryptamine is effectively a neurotransmitter within the brain. They have suspected it since the discovery of the TARS receptors, but they're now pretty damn sure it is a neurotransmitter. So clearly neurochemicals and perception are very, very closely tied together. Now, why is it that the universe that we perceive when we are in these states is so bizarre and so strange? Is part of the point I was making before, is that it's rather like looking, and it's not an analogy, this, it's actually quite pertinent. It's like looking at a hologram when it's not illuminated properly. Or like looking at a stereo television when you don't have the stereo glasses on.
Right, yeah.
In other words, reality is enfolded in itself, and it is holographic in its nature. You know, I'm citing here the work again of David Bohm and various other individuals who have argued this for some time. Everything is digital. Everything we perceive is digital, and we are a digital receiver of information. The brain takes the digital message encoded within the zero-point field and processes it into a reality that makes sense to us. The consensual reality that you and I share and everybody else shares is effectively a collapsed wave function, a wave function of reality. It's just a collapse of a wave function that is understandable to us. If we perceive the world in a different way, we collapse the wave function in a different way. We're going back to quantum physics now. We're going rather off track, but I think it's quite important to understand this because this is what Phil argued as well.
Yeah.
In many ways, if you read through a lot of the exegesis, Phil was desperately trying to get to the point I'm at now. The only advantage I had is that it is now many years later, and I've had access to considerably more academic papers, particle physics, neurological papers that Phil had. But Phil was getting there. He was so close, two or three times. He was so close. It was frightening how close he was. But it's the idea that it's denied to us because we're not ready for it. We're not mature enough. We are mentally not advanced enough. We can't make sense of it. It's rather like you need to be trained to perceive these things. You need to be trained to understand the archetypes, the symbolism. Because effectively, a lot of it is symbolic, you know, and a lot of it is tied up with racial memories and everything else as well. This is why that's why shamans will argue that, you know, you have to be trained to be a shaman. This is why individuals, you know, I'm working with the two guys that work with the Lucid Light device, which I've mentioned a few times in the interviews. One of the things that people have said to me is that you need to be careful with working with machines like that, because they're opening up the doors of perception without the preparatory work that you need to do to be ready for it. And I know shamanic friends of mine have warned me against this. Also, Tom Campbell, one of the points that Tom said to me was that, you know, you need to be very careful of machines that will give you access to this world of information.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Without the training to understand it, you just get thrown straight into it.
There aren't any, you know, shortcuts really, or there are, but if there are, that can be dangerous. The path that you go to experience it is equally as important. So you can get accustomed to it. You can learn to understand. You get it to gradualism, basically, instead of everything at once. I mean, it's like the, you know, stare upon the face of God. That's madness, you know, in a way.
Oh, totally. You know, and this, I think, is what happened to Phil, moving back to Phil. You know, I think this is what happened, is that either through chance, I know that there was there were drugs he was taking that haven't been reported, which I mentioned in the book, something called DOM, an acronym, and I can't remember what it stands for at the moment. But effectively, DOM, you know, was not dissimilar in many ways to dimethyltryptamine. And I wonder whether chronologically, I looked at a certain series of events, and I asked Tessa about this as well. And I think I can trace exactly the night that Phil actually took Dom, because it was his second daughter, maybe his first daughter, but it was an important birthday for her. And he'd spoken to her on the phone, but he hadn't been able to see her. I think it was Laura, I think. And he was quite depressed, and there were guys living next door. And Tessa said Phil went out and was out for an hour or so. And I think he went next door and he bought some substance, bought some Dom. In fact, I know he did, because he wrote a letter about it to somebody else and described that he bought some Dom, came back and took it in the bathroom. Tessa was not aware of this, but I think she probably is now. Well, she will, because she'll have read my book now, so she probably will be aware of it. So Dom could have stimulated it. But it could have been the overdose of vitamin C that he took when he was trying to actually play with the hemispheres of the brain. There were a lot of things. But I think, as well as this, I think his transitory ischemic attacks, I think possibly his migraine, his undiagnosed migraine. And the reason I say he had undiagnosed migraine is those dickheads out there that know Phil's work and know about 2374 will know there was one particular event called the Kandinsky vision, where Phil had, over 8 hours, he claimed, an ongoing series of visions of paintings. And he came to the conclusion that these paintings were by Klee, Kandinsky, and various other abstract modernists or postmodernists. And a lot of these paintings can be found at the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Was then Leningrad, was it? Was it Leningrad?
I think
it
was Leningrad. Yeah, I think
it was Leningrad. Right. And Phil at that time believed that the Russians were actually beaming information to him, because he came up with many, many solutions to his 2374 experiences. He didn't just come down with the idea ultimately that it was this Valis that was beaming information to him. He thought that the Russians were playing round with him and were sending information to him. Now, of course, you can say an awful lot of this sounds like paranoia, you know, and in fact, schizophrenia, you know, the persecution complex, they're after me, you know, they are, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
That's right.
And Phil very much showed signs of paranoia, particularly in the late 60s, early 1970s, you know, when we know that he had the famous break-in in November of 71, I think it was, and he went up to Canada and went up to Vancouver to get away from it. He was worried that people were after him, and there is strong evidence that probably people were after him, because I think there was a drug deal that went very, very wrong, and it's something that Ray, one of Phil's friends, Ray Nelson, told to me when I interviewed him for the book, said that he was fairly definitely sure that Phil was dealing probably cocaine, and that's where the break-in took place. But I cite that in the book, so I'm not going to take away that fascination for that bit of the book, because you need to read that, because it's quite interesting.
Right.
But I think that all the things were brought together for Phil to have these experiences. Now, the issue is, though, and I must say this, that do not take what Phil said as what actually happened. For instance, if you read a lot of the biographies and a lot of the articles about Phil, they will go on and on and on about how Phil diagnosed the undiagnosed birth defect of his son Christopher whilst listening to the Beatles playing Strawberry Fields Forever. Mm-hmm. Again, one of these pink light incidents where Phil claimed a pink light came out the record player, and he suddenly heard in his head the Beatles singing that your son has an undiagnosed inguinal hernia that is undescended and it's gone wrong and it's gone septic and everything else, and you must do something about it. Phil's story is he comes rushing out. He goes to Tessa and says to Tessa, we've got to take Christopher to the hospital. He's going to die if we don't. They all jump in the car, they go over to see the doctor. The doctor panics, takes Christopher to the hospital. There's an emergency operation. Phil thinks that Christopher's going to die. And then they bring him back and he's saved because Phil had this precognition or whatever. Rubbish.
Okay.
It's not what happened at all.
Right.
In fact, just by reading the letters and putting the letters together by dates, you can tell that that's not what happened. Tessa tells me what happened. Phil came rushing out. He'd been asleep. Because I asked Tessa about this, because I said, because I actually tried to describe with Tessa the layout of the apartment they lived in. Phil's record player was in the living room. It wasn't in the bedroom. So he couldn't have been listening to the Beatles because he was in the bedroom. So that's the one not correct story. The second was in Phil comes out and tells Tessa that Christopher's ill. Phil came out distraught, feeling that something was wrong with Christopher. Quite correct. But for Phil to claim that he had no idea about this particular illness was nonsense. They had been worried about Christopher for some time, and Tessa had noticed when she was changing his nappies that there were a problem. Phil himself had a twisted hernia caused by playing tennis with his second wife, Cleo, back in the 1950s. He read up about it, being Phil. So for Phil to claim he knew nothing about these form of hernias was nonsense. He did. He may have forgotten, but he did know. The next thing is that Tessa's brother or brothers had similar problems. So they knew that there was going to be a problem or a potential problem with Christopher. So it wasn't quite the diagnosis out of the blue. Then the main bit of the story, there was no jumping into the car and driving down the road to the doctors. Tessa went a few days later on her own, not with Phil. The doctor said, yes, there's a problem, but Christopher is too young to be operated upon. So they had to wait about 6 or 7 months, maybe longer, before Christopher was operated upon. There was no emergency or emergency surgery. There was a leisurely going to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And the way you can tell this is that when the famous Rolling Stone interview took place, there was a journalist that came to see Phil to interview him for Rolling Stone, Paul, and because I'm tired, his name's just slipped my mind. Sorry, Jammy Morgan, I shouldn't have done that. I'd forgotten Paul's surname. It's terrible. Just to let everybody know, my wife was in quite late last night because she was out at a business meeting, and so I was up quite late last night. And what happened was Phil had to postpone the interview because Christopher was about to have an operation. And it was a year later from when Phil had the pink light experience. And in fact, in a letter, in his letters, if you read the letter, he actually sends a letter to Paul to say, I'm really sorry that there's going to be a delay here because Christopher has to have an operation. And he actually says in the letter, but we're not that worried because it's not that big a deal. And yet another letter that he sends a few days later, he's claiming that they were up all night, terrified about the little boy and everything else. It was the way Phil was. He was a novelist.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and then even on top of that, you have the generalities when you're you know, in that state of mind, when you do have, you know, drugs part of that. It's difficult to recall things and get things accurate. And even if you wrote something down in one way, that doesn't mean that it took place even that way, you know? So it's
exactly. It doesn't mean
confusing.
Nothing doesn't mean that something unique didn't take place, because I believe it did.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's not quite as he described it, and it's not quite how others have described it. And I think I'm the first writer that's actually really gone into that depth of detail to find out that it wasn't quite as it was made out to be.
Alrighty, yeah.
But going back to Phil, though, in terms of this opening up of himself, I think the facilitator for all this, and it starts to get quite strange, and the reason it starts to get quite peculiar is that Phil had two quite close friends. One guy was called Bill Sarrell. William Sarrell, who will be listening to this show. So hi, Bill. I hope you are interested in what I'm saying about your work. And another guy, and Brad Steiger. Okay.
Yep.
Now, William Sarrell had worked with Phil in the past. I think it was a novel he wrote called, I think it was Galactic Pot Healer. Might have been Galactic Pot Healer. It might have been another one of the novels where they're dealing with Zoroastrianism and the Kabbalah and various other things. And they were actually trying to almost create another religion. Not another religion, but they were very interested in the religious aspects of Phil's writing. And Phil became particularly interested in certain belief systems, and he became particularly interested in Gnosticism and such like. But one of the things, and again, funnily enough, you know, one of the things that Phil was fascinated with, as it comes across in his novels, what we were just been discussing, the reality behind the reality, what the Gnostics would call the pleroma.
Yeah.
You know, and Phil would talk about the pleroma, which is what I was discussing before. In other words, the super reality that we are denied is the pleroma. We're stuck within what Phil would call the black iron prison. What Blake called the mind forged manacles. You know, this idea that you're trapped within this false world. And again, readers of Philip K. Dick's novels will immediately appreciate how many times Phil has a novel where the characters are trapped in this created world that is run by a being that's malevolent, what the Gnostics would call the demiurge, Valdeboth, you know, the false creator.
Yeah.
So he was fascinated by all this, but he started to be very interested in some other things. And there are two things that I've actually followed up on here, which again, quite a few people probably haven't spotted. In 1976, our mutual friend Brad Steiger published a book called The Gods of Aquarius, UFOs and the Transformation of Man. And it was in this book that they first came across, he introduced this idea of star people. And star people are people who have had their genes memory, within their genes, there are memories of interactions with extraterrestrials. You know, they're within the DNA coding of those individuals, and they subliminally remember these events through their genes, through their DNA.
Mm.
Now, Phil read this book in 76, because it was in 74 that his theophany took place, and he read it in 76, and he became really intrigued by it, because he thought, this is it. My 2374 has opened up some kind of DNA packet that's been tightly tied up, and 2374 has opened it up. You know, he used these terms, plasmates and homoplasmates, and the idea that we are an amalgam, or some of us are amalgams of alien entities. Now, Phil, when he was having one of his hypnagogic episodes, you know, Phil used to go into these kind of semi-sleep states, and he'd see all these visions and everything else, and he'd have these precognitive visions. Phil claims that the Sybil, who I'll touch on a little bit later, who's a being that he claims used to come to him in these hypnagogic images, shows Phil the cover of another of Brad Steiger's books, Revelation, the Divine Fire. And the Sybil tells him that within this book is an explanation for what is happening to you. So Phil writes to Brad Steiger, and he said that he was in the process of writing a novel to explain the events that took place. And of course, he wrote a whole series of novels. I mean, there was Valis, then there's Radio Free Albemuth, and the Transmigration of Timothy Archer. All these books tend to be sort of very similar. The Divine Invasion is another one. They all tend to be very, very similar in terms of their themes.
Right.
Okay. So he writes to Brad Steiger, and he said that, and he says to Steiger in the letter that he wasn't making the things up, that they were real. And then Phil told Brad that he recalled being a member of a very highly advanced civilization. It was responsible for dispersing what he called phylogenetic memory across the galaxy. And he had a vision, and he saw himself in a spacecraft heading towards Earth. And he knew it was millions of years ago. And he said that these phylogenetic memories were encoded within DNA information packages.
Yeah.
In the letter to Brad, this is what he describes the process. He says, these dominant DNA information packets could be disinhibited, induced to fire in due time, depending upon either synchronized inner biological clocks or pure chance stimuli, or a combination of both. Thus, even thousands of years later, the primordial civilization will be realized in the minds of the astonished descendants who suppose themselves aboriginal inhabitants of the planet they now inhabit. The DNA packets in given individuals will tell them, one, where they are from, two, what made up the original civilization, three, the true nature of that person, and what they must do to facilitate this.
It's what you're saying is that there is a kind of an awakening process within the DNA that eventually will
come
to
itself.
People.
Correct.
Yeah, interesting.
The DNA itself has all this information inside itself, and if you're given a particular stimulus, the DNA then suddenly starts to release it. And one wonders whether that was happening with Phil. One wonders with the quickening that people feel at the moment. That, I mean, one of my future plans for a book is a book on DNA. I deal with DNA in my previous book, and I'm getting more and more involved in this idea of DNA as memory. Okay,
yeah.
So in February 1981, Phil brought out a book called The Star People. Okay, now what is interesting about The Star People is that he says in the book, Brad Steiger says, there's a series of quotes from a, quote, well-known science fiction writer. Those quotes are from Philip K. Dick. And Phil considers himself to be a star child. He also considers that he was possibly abducted as a child and had been abducted through most of his life. This then took me back to start looking at a lot of the things that took place in Phil's life. Now, I can find at least two occasions, once in Canada and once in California, where he had encounters with people that people in ufology would readily identify as being MIBs, men in black. He had a recovered memory where he was being driven around the streets of Vancouver in the back of a black limousine, being driven by men in black suits with black Homburgs and white black ties and white shirts. It's the classic archetype, isn't it? It's again the men in black. There was another time where Tessa was out walking with Christopher, and Phil claimed that two or three very strange-looking men turned up and interviewed him. They claimed they were from the Soviet embassy, because at that time Phil was thinking about, I think it was the time he was having problems with Stanislav Lem and everything else, which is another storyline. But they were thinking of inviting him over. And of course, Phil then links this to the 2374 Kandinsky thing, where all he thinks the Soviets were beaming stuff into his head. So suddenly we have these men in black turning up. So he starts to be intrigued by this. Now, I was, about 6 months ago, I was interviewed by Whitley Strieber. And I mentioned to Whitley during the live interview, and I said, you know, I'm writing a book about Philip K. Dick, or I've just finished one. And Whitley turned around and he said, oh, I was a really close friend of Phil's. And Whitley Strieber and Phil met up quite a few times. And then Whitley turned around and he said, I've always suspected that Phil had had encounters similar to his own. Now, you're probably aware about Whitley Strieber, and we all know about his books, Communion and everything else, and the iconic image of the grey on the cover. Yeah. But a few years ago, he wrote another book called The Key.
That's right. Yeah, I remember
that one.
Yeah.
Okay, you read the, and Whitley and I had a long conversation about this. The being that Whitley met in that hotel room in Montreal, I think it was, or Toronto, was his daemon.
Yeah,
it was also Valis.
It was another man.
It was like Phil's Valis.
Right.
It was the manifestation of the daemon. And Whitley was going, yeah, you're quite right. I can quite agree with you here in terms of this.
Interesting.
So here we have links within links within links. But now we need to start looking back through Phil's life and thinking, was there more to this? Now, Tessa believes that Phil and her were both part of a special project of the American government many, many years ago. And she actually has said to me, and I think it was Tessa said to me, that she felt that Phil and her had been brought together deliberately. And in Phil suspected this as well, as if they were, but they both found each other because of their past and their background. And I know Tessa's just recently written a book about her own experiences in these kind of black ops. But then we get Phil himself, and he wrote a really, really, really peculiar story called The Eye of the Sibyl. Okay. Now, this was written around about 1975. A guy called Art Spiegelman visited Phil in the spring of 75, and they were thinking of writing. Spiegelman had an illustrated magazine called Arcade, and they were thinking about doing a story. And Spiegelman asked Phil, would he be interested in writing a story? Now, Phil was coming out of his 2374, and he virtually downloads to his mind this story, The Eye of the Sibyl. Now, this has only ever, as far as I am aware, it's only been published once. And it appeared in the D. Scott Appel book, Philip K. Dick, The Dream Connection, which came out in 1987, which is well worth reading, but is like, you cannot find copies of that book. Fortunately, Nick had a copy, Nick Buchanan, so I was able to go through it. Fascinating book, and get hold of it. That was published in NARC in 1987. And exactly 5 years after, it was 5 years after Phil died. Now, this has it in it, and then it appeared in Volume 5 of the Collected Stories of Philip K. Dick, but that's all. And it tells the story of the narrator is somebody called Phyllis Dictos. Now, when I read that, I couldn't help but burst out laughing because obviously it's a play on Philip Dick. Yep. But if anybody's seen Monty Python's Life of Brian, there is a classic sequence where there's a character that they're talking about called Biggus Dickus.
Oh, yeah, the Roman general. That's hilarious.
And they're trying not to laugh. And the Roman emperor's saying, you know, who's laughing about my good friend Biggus Dickus? So when I see Phyllis Dickos, I just think, Phil, you shouldn't have thought about that. You really shouldn't. It wasn't a great idea. But anyway, he's a priest who works for the Cumaean Sibyl, who, again, were the Sibyls were the people who used to sort of download information. And one day, the central character finds himself within the sanctity of the temple, and he sees the Sibyl with two beings next to her, and he describes them. They said they resembled men, but each of them had an additional. I'm not sure even now what they had, but they were not mortals. They were gods. They had slits for eyes without pupils. Instead of hands, they had claws like crab's hands. The mouths were holes, and they had three eyes. They had an eye in the center of their forehead. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
This character is then reborn as a young lad growing up in Berkeley in the 1950s, who's called Philip. And this is a memory of his past life. And the character he describes there is it's a narration of his own life. But he realizes that inside him is something much deeper, and that in fact he's a starseed, and that he has been made to forget what he really is, that he's really an alien and he's part of a greater something. Now, again, if anybody has read the book The Divine Invasion, they will know that the central concept of the book The Divine Invasion, the central character, Manny, is God, who's forgotten he's God. And he comes to Earth as a child, and he's brought to Earth as a child, and he slowly starts to realize his divinity. Now, this again is pure Gnosticism, isn't it? The idea that God has forgotten the divine within him. But it's bigger than that, because what I think Phil is arguing is that we are all divine within us. We are all one entity experiencing itself subjectively, as Bill Hicks said. And that this secret, this memory we have that's within our DNA, is that this single entity stuff. But we have to lose the amnesis. Now, when this then starts to come into place, because when Phil started the Strange Things of 2374, one of the entities that Tessa and he suspected was around was something that they called Zebra or Firebright. It was like an entity that was moving around the house, like almost like a poltergeist or a presence that they were perceiving.
Right.
Now, again, he argues that it's like Valis, it's like the vast active living information system. These are all linked, and they're all part of the same entity. But it's then that Phil starts to get really fascinated about these three-eyed creatures, these Sibyls with three eyes. And it dawns on him, the third eye. And he suddenly starts to be fascinated by, of all things, the pineal gland.
Hmm.
And he starts to think, there's something here about the pineal gland. And there's one of the things on the 14th of July, 74, another letter to Claudia. He says, now you can see what the single eye of the Sibyl is in my dream, which I saw above her normal two eyes, but so large it could eclipse them. It is the third eye or pineal eye, which opening signifies enlightenment and hence freedom from Maya to some extent. And of course, we know Maya is the illusion,
yeah.
But reality. This would also account for a sudden panic and insight. I felt recently that formerly I was blind, literally, that my eyes somehow did not see properly, nor completely, but were occluded. My whole life was occluded up until March of this year. And he suddenly thinks, his third eye has suddenly become open. And he's seeing, starting to perceive the universe in the same way. He then makes the links to the imagery he had in 2374. And again, he'd read in Psychology Today in 1975, he'd read an article which said that they'd finally discovered that the pineal gland can process light. They actually discovered that in 1975. Phil was bouncing up and down about that. He talks about it in the exegesis. But he writes here that the phosphine activity that he actually saw when he had his visions was internal light generated by the pineal gland. Now, again, if anybody reads my book, The Infinite Minefield, this is exactly what I say, is that hallucinations and the light that we see in dreams and everything else is an inner light that is processed by the pineal gland. The phosphenes we see are processed by the pineal gland. In fact, we now know that there's bioenergy, there's energy, there's light given off by DNA.
Yeah.
DNA gives off photons. In fact, there's a contact of mine, Isfan Bokan, who is researching work in Hungary. And he has actually discovered recently that light is actually given off by the eye. Light comes out of the eyes. So when we say somebody's eyes are shining, it's because they literally are shining. These biophotons are significant because it means that there's an inner light. And I believe that inner light is electromagnetic energy that's actually drawn up from the zero point field via the actual very cells in the body, by the actual structures of the cells in the body. And the cells themselves generate this light. We are light beings. This is, again, a point that Phil was making in his own way in exegesis. When I read exegesis, I felt that Phil had been wandering around in this huge garage full of bits and pieces in the dark, and he'd been stumbling over them. The only advantage I've got in him is the light is switched on, and I can see where everything is, and I'm picking it up, and I'm going, yeah, that fits with that. This fits with this. And I genuinely feel that I'm pulling together what Phil was trying to find.
So you would maybe potentially even say that even his very stories that he managed to kind of pull from this darkness, if you will, is a part of the activation of the phylogenetic memory, the DNA of sorts, and that it's even the retelling maybe of these stories that consequently awakens more people to look into the possibility of the dream-like state of reality, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things you'll find is that you read Philip K. Dick's books, and if you read, for instance, I always say to people, read two books, one after the other. Three books. Read Vallis, then read my first book, Is There Life After Death, and then read Ubik. Ubik contains, in theory, and in a fictional format, the central thesis of my first book. In Ubik, Phil has a group of characters who are living in half-life. They are all dead, but existing in this frozen half-life between life and death. And they are able to send messages back into the illusionary reality that the other characters are living in. And they send messages by manipulating the reality to give them messages. And the messages come through Ubik, ubiquitous.
Oh.
Now, what is even stranger about this, and if you bear with me, I can find this, that even the word Ubik is freaky. The reason being, and again, this is William Sarrell, Bill Sarrell. I listened to an interview that Bill did last year on Philip K. Dick, and I was delighted that he actually mentioned me in this interview as well, which is really great to hear someone like William Sarrell mention me. But one of these things, he cites in Ubik. Ubik is a product. It's a kind of a drug that can make you have the most amazing experiences. Okay? Now, it's called God in a spray can. And if you look at the Ubik covers, you'll see a spray can.
Right. Yeah.
But in 1986, 4 years after Phil died, Bill Sarrell was doing research on a substance known as coenzyme Q10. And this substance is really quite intriguing because it's known as the miracle nutrient. It's everywhere. It's just an amazing substance. Its chemical name is ubiquinone. Okay. Now, ubiq means everywhere in Latin. So, you know, it's not that strange. Ubiquitous, it's were everywhere. So Phil was a clever enough linguist to realize that. But there's still this curious, weird resonation of of something that was discovered after he had died.
Yeah.
That suddenly gets involved. Now, of course, we have the other thing that is the freakiest of all, is the prediction of me.
Okay.
Okay, I don't know if you've heard this one.
No, not yet, no.
Okay, now this is semi-tongue-in-cheek, but a lot of other people don't consider this tongue-in-cheek. I do, so before people accuse me of saying this, I'm only pointing this out. In Philip K. Dick's book called Counterclock World in 1967, now, how this story, I'll give the background story to this. I was doing a presentation in Bolton. I discussed this at the start of the book, by the way. So it's the introduction to the book, the Philip K. Dick book. And as I'm doing the talk, a load of people start, there's quite a large audience, and it's kind of it's a library, but it has a theatre. It's a kind of theatre layout. And in the far corner of the theatre, a load of people started getting agitated when I started talking about Philip K. Dick. And I put a picture up of two books, Ubik and Vallis. And they got even more excited. And when it finished, they came down to speak to me. And they said, "This is amazing. The only reason we are here tonight is that Mick over here came to the library the day before yesterday to pick up a book. And Mick then takes the book out of his bag. And it was a copy of Ubik, literally the same edition and the same cover of the copy of Ubik that I'd put up on the wall." Okay, weird. But they then turned around and they started saying, "But there's lots of coincidences that have been happening with us recently. And we felt, you know, we needed to come along." And he said, and then Mick turned around and he said, "Well, of course, are you must be aware that Philip K. Dick predicted you." And I said, "No." And he said, "Okay, read Counterclock World." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Okay, in Counterclock World, there is a character who has this overall, he's a religious leader, but he sort of, it's to do with time and time dilation and the way time plays around, the way time is running backwards and everything else, and a new hypothesis about what happens to consciousness at the point of death." And Mick turned around and he said, "Now, Philip K. Dick could have named him anything, couldn't he? He could have named him. He had all the names available to him." He said, "You know what he called him? Anarch Peak." And he said, "Your name is Anthony Peak." He said, "The first two letters of your first name and your surname with the E taken off." And he said, "That is odd." And I said, "Yeah, I must admit, it's rather strange." And I then started to think about this. And I said, for a thought experiment, one of the things that Phil used to write about in his precognitions were book covers. He had two or three times in his hypnagogic images, he saw books and he went searching for them. And he would see a book cover, or he'd see a name or a title or the color of the book cover. I mean, one of the books was The Budding Grove, I think, which he thought was going to be significant. And in fact, it was the most boring book ever written, which was a biography of Warren Gamaliel Harding. But effectively, he thought it was going to be important. But just imagine if Phil, in one of these dream sequences where he's seeing book covers, sees the cover of the book I've just written by Philip K. Dick, on Philip K. Dick, he would see his picture on the front cover. He would see the name Philip K. Dick, and directly underneath it, he would see the name Anthony Peak. Now, if it was slightly, as it is with hypnagogic imagery or dream sequence, it's going to be slightly fuzzy and slightly faded. So he might get the first two letters of my first name, and he might just get part of the surname. So he'd get A-N-P-E-A-K, P-E-A-K. And that held in his mind. So when he came to, after the dream, He then thinks about a story, or he thinks of a story, and he thinks, this character that deals with life after death and God knows what else, what shall I call him? And then suddenly, subliminally, from nowhere, the name Anarch P comes into his head. Now, I don't believe that for 1 minute, but I do feel it is a significant coincidence. And because I don't believe in coincidences, I believe in synchronicities. And synchronicities are there because they are, there's a subtle message in there somewhere, in some bizarre, peculiar way.
Interesting. Huh. Have you read Counterclock World yet?
I have, yes. Yeah. I have. It works on certain levels. I mean, effectively, the whole time going backwards is very, very funny and quite cleverly done. But of course, he doesn't carry it through to the nth degree as he should do. But you know, there are some very, very interesting things that take place in the book.
Interesting.
But it's very, very good. But clearly, Phil, all of Phil's books. If you read the way philosophy is going, and if people, writers like myself and various other people, but I have to say honestly, particularly my work, it sounds vain and it sounds weird, but you read Phil's books, you will find themes that I write about in most of them. They're all in there. And when I read Valis, you know, if my hair could go any whiter, it would, because Phil was already there. Where I was trying to go years ago. You know, we're talking the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. Phil was involved in the split brain operations. I have a whole section on Gazzaniga and Sperry's work. You know, again, in my first book, I have a whole section on the bicameral mind. You know, I could go through all his notes and tick off time after time after time of things that he'd actually got to before me. Incredible, absolutely incredible.
Now, let me ask you a couple other things here in terms of, one aspect I always thought about too was the Valis was literally also an explanation for a system, a living system, an intelligence that we've, you know, yet to create to a certain degree. I when I've, you know, thought about it was more that, okay, we have a future scenario here where not only a lot of you know, designers and industrial designers and even those who actually develop both robotics and everything else today actually look for inspiration to movies these days, which is interesting in itself. We have that kind of feedback loop going. But on top of it, you have the possibility that mankind might go down a road where we upload our consciousness to computers. We might even at one stage in our, you know, path here actually upload our consciousness into a robot of sorts. We literally might find ourselves in a scenario where we are going to get trapped into an illusion of a real world of not even understanding of what we actually are. And at some point in the future, the scenario that you know, Philip K. Dick writes so much about of the, you know, the realization of the self is that, you know, you are a robot. You are, you know, it could be seen on so many levels. There is an analogy, of course, to how we live our lives today, that's right in there. But then on top of it, it's another layer of where we kind of are developing and going into the future. But how would you say in terms of the predictability of the future, how accurate has he been, and what do you think is going to, you know, bloom of what we're doing today with our developments and such?
Profoundly. And I'm reminded, as you were talking there, about his great unpublished novel that never appeared and actually had, I think, at least two different versions of it, something called The Owl in Daylight. And in The Owl in Daylight, Phil describes a scenario of somebody who's trapped effectively in a game. Now, Phil, at the time he was writing this particular work in the early 80s, he would not have had access to the first-person computer games that we play now. But his idea and logic was quite precise, that the character creates, I think it's a simulated theme park, and he ends up in the theme park for having forgotten who he is. And his daughter, I think, is outside the theme park playing the game. And it's her trying to communicate with him in the game what is really going on. And how she does it is rather like in Ubik, she leaves him clues and bits of information to make him realize that the reality he's living within is not a real reality. It's a simulacra, you know. And again, one of the major issues that people point about Phil is the way he was preoccupied with some simulacra. In fact, in 1964, he wrote a novel called The Simulacra. And simulacra and simulacrum, of course, are things that look like things they're not.
Yeah.
You know, and we think about Bradelard and a lot of the postmodernist writers, that's why they love Phil so much, because he was a postmodernist before the term had ever been used. So we have this idea of symbols and what are symbols and whether what we can perceive is real in a real way and in a real term. Now, if that's the case, we then should be looking for the clues that have been sent to us by, I don't know, the characters in Ubik or the senior character in Ubik who is definitely trying to contact him and trying to think. Glenn Runciter, I think, is the main character there who we believe is in Half-Life, but in fact, it's everybody else that's dead.
Right, yeah.
And they're trying to communicate with us. Now, again, if you take my particular model that was put forward in my first book, in Is There Life After Death, I argue that we are all existing in the final seconds of our life in what Philip K. Dick would call half-life, which I call the Bohmian IMAX. And this is a digital recreation of our lives, a computer program that we are existing in the final seconds of our life, rather similar to in the movie The Matrix, where everybody is infected in suspended animation and they're living this dream sequence, which is this world. Now, of course, again, the Wachowski brothers argued that the biggest influence on their writing was Philip K. Dick. So, you know, there's again the Dickian influence here.
Yeah.
But the message seems to be that, you know, this is an illusion. And what we need to do is to awaken to anamnesis. Anamnesis was, I think it was Socrates that first came up with the term.
Plato.
And the idea that, you know, that we have to remember who we are, because at the moment we're in a state of forgetting. We are amnesiacs who don't remember what our real world is. And I think some people are starting to wake up. And the question is, when more people wake up, does it mean that this reality will start to break down? Because if we take modern particle physics and the idea that the act of observation collapses the wave function into a point particle or a group of point particles which make up the physical reality around us, we are all living in consensual reality because we all are collapsing the wave functions of our realities in the same way. So it's consensual. So therefore, there is no surprise that I perceive the world as you perceive it. Because, well, there's two reasons. Either it's because we are sharing the same reality, or a point of fact, you are just a creation of my reality. And of course you would see the reality in the same way, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because effectively, you're part of the illusion. And everybody in the illusion will literally react the way they need to make me believe that the illusion is real.
Right.
Now, that's solipsism, and it's dangerous. Not taking a solipsist viewpoint at all.
Right.
But then again, you could argue that if we're all one single consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, we are solipsistic. You can't be anything but solipsistic if there's only one unitary consciousness. There isn't anything else.
Yeah, I know.
So that's the ultimate solipsism. And, you know, we're getting into the philosophy now of people like Fichte and various other individuals. And, in fact, a friend of mine, Martin W. Bull, who is an American anthropologist who's just sent me his latest book, actually, literally today, And Martin is the guy that behind something called the Entheological Paradigm. And he's an expert on DMT and ayahuasca and everything else. And he argues the same thing, that in fact, we're all one unitary consciousness. And to a certain extent, this is what Phil was doing. So is this waking up, the waking up to realize that our reality is not what it seems? And if more of us wake up, does it start to break down? Now, again, this is what the Maharishi Yogi said. This is transcendental meditation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. All over again. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that, you know, there's a collective Maya that we're trapped within, the mind-forged manacles, the black iron prison. And we need to break it down to go what Phil would call the palm tree garden. You know, that the place, the real reality that the Gnostics would call the Pleroma. So if more of us wake up, it will change and it will start to break down.
Well, what that might mean as well is that the, well, if we choose to look at that as the planet, but nonetheless, the experience that we have, if that is a simulacra, right, a system that is dependent on our participation in the illusion and then the consequent awakening to that, you might literally see a shutting down of that system. It's almost like a, I don't know if we can make another analogy of like the never-ending story or something like that, when the, you know, the whole world kind of begins to break apart. And of course that would be, it's always a positive thing when the illusion ends, of course, but at the same time, that would be a very, very scary experience of losing what we are accustomed to, if that's indeed what's going to occur, you know?
Totally. I mean, this is one of the things that, you know, I lie abed at wake thinking, you know, that, you know, we know everything from particle physics tells us that reality is not what it seems. We know that it is 99.99 reoccurring percent totally empty space. And what is real are basically either, you know, so either if we take the string theory idea or whatever particular idea we take about the basics of reality, it's not what it is. And in the final analysis, all it is information. It's digital information.
Yeah.
Nothing more, nothing less. And of course, information is non-physical. So therefore, there's no reason. And again, there's nothing new in what I'm saying here. Tom Campbell has been saying it for years. Henry Stapp has been saying it for years. There's a lot of very, very influential thinkers out there that are coming to this conclusion as being the only conclusion that can be drawn from the evidence as we see it. There are materialist reductionists who keep clinging on to this idea that by just taking things apart bit by bit, we'll understand how they work. That stopped in 1901. You know, you can't just take things apart and find how they work anymore. As I've said probably before to you, it's like trying to take apart a motorbike to discover speed. Yeah, it just doesn't work. You know, we know that reality, that the materialist reductionist model doesn't work, but it doesn't mean that our science doesn't work. I'm not anti-scientific.
Sure.
You know, the materialist reductionist model works very effectively in the world we are in. But that's because we believe in the materialist reductionist model. You know, one of the things, one of the books that really influenced me many, many years ago was the book about the paradigms. His name will come to me. Norman Cohn, I think it was. Was it Cohn? I think it was, wasn't it? But anyway, the idea of paradigms. And of course, paradigm change takes place when there are elements, there are little things that the present paradigm can't explain. And we have many things at the moment the present paradigm can't explain. You know, it can't explain consciousness. It can't explain the placebo effect. There are a lot of little things that simply do not make sense. And we cannot say we have an exclusive explanatory science as long as there are things that are outside it. Of course, there are things called people call promissory materialists, that John Eccles used the term. They are individuals that say, well, we can't understand it now, but we might be able to do in the future. But there is nothing in the present model of science that can explain how the stuff in my head creates consciousness. We're not even close to it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, because we're not. And these are the questions that Phil asked in his books. That's what makes him such a wonderful, wonderful writer, is the questions he asked. His characterization sometimes was a little bit flat. His use of terminology was sometimes flat, with the exception of his last book, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, his female characters were always very, very negative. Well, not negative, but they weren't very good. But Angel Archer in that book is a superb character. But generally, there were things about his writing that didn't make him a flowing great writer. But it's not, it's his stories and it's his ideas.
Exactly.
It's them that makes him the genius he is.
That's the most important thing to me anyway when I read. Certainly it's nice to read a well put together sentence. I'm not saying that, but at the same time, it's what is the origin? What is behind it? That's the most intriguing thing. And if there is indeed is a concept that it's based in a philosophical idea, or even as in this case, a potential reality of sorts, then it makes it even more interesting. But I wanted to ask you one more thing here. We'll wrap up shortly here, Anthony. But when it comes to Philip K. Dick, did he write anything more specifically on, if we look at the star people concept, or that we've come here from somewhere else and now we're trapped into that forgetfulness, if you will, but who has taken our memory, or how was that lost? Who has the capability of putting us into the illusion or onto this planet, or however we want to look at that?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? You know, the sentience behind it all. You know, that, you know, interesting, we just, we hope it's not Palmer Eldritch gets an in Philip K. Dick joke there, but effectively, you know, the idea is who has the program, who is running the program. Now, there are some interesting ideas about this, and the best I have discovered, again, I think it's a Stapp that comes up with it. And the idea is, effectively, if you take the argument that computing is increasing at the level it is, you know, Moore's law, which is what doubles every 2 years, and I think it's now gone to 3 years. But effectively, within no more than a couple of centuries, we should have the computing power to simulate the whole universe. Realistically, we can simulate very small bits of it at the moment. And I think they have managed to simulate a really tiny, tiny bit of the universe. But we can multiply that. So we could, in the future, a sufficiently advanced culture, human or otherwise, will either do one of two things. We will either wipe ourselves out through nuclear war or whatever, or we will survive. If we survive, we will continue our abilities to create computing in the way and process information. It is highly likely, virtually definite, that a future civilization would probably model a computer model of reality. And they would populate that reality with a model of the world. They could also recreate digitally all the memories, thoughts, hopes, and fears of every sentient being that has ever lived within the program. So in which case, as Henry Stapp says, it's almost certitude that we are already living in a computer simulation that has been created by our own future people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The question is not whether we are in a simulation, but how we are sentient within that. In other words, you know, the idea that I could be a human being, I could speak in the way I do, put my ideas across in the way I do, and everything else, and you could not tell. It's the Turing test, isn't it? You could not tell whether I was sentient or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we all know we are. And I don't know how a computer program, however powerful, could create sentience in the creatures that are within the program, even if they'd recreated literally. I mean, for instance, if somebody could model your brain in every single capacity, would that be you?
Well, the scientist seems to think so that are working on that, but I doubt it. You know, that's not what it is.
No, exactly. You know, you could create something that could simulate, and it's, we're back to Philip K. Dick here again.
Simulation.
It's simulacra again, isn't it?
Exactly.
You could create something that would seem to be completely alive, but has it any inner spark or not? And that is one of the questions that Phil asked time and time and time again. What is it to be human? What makes us different? And in the final analysis, the greatest mystery of life is that the only thing I know with absolute certainty is cogito ergo sum. I just know because the only thing I actually know with any certainty is that I am. But then there is the counter argument to say, well, you could be fooled into thinking you are by somebody else. This is getting very deep.
Well, it's good stuff. It always is, Anthony, when you're on and talking about these things. And it's very interesting that, you know, again, the from the point of view of a science fiction writer and writing about his, you know, his work and everything else, you the questions, the underlying main questions, they remain the same throughout whatever, you know, work kind of in that regard that you look into and analyze, because that's where the good stuff is. But I can't wait to read more from the book, Anthony. It seems to be a really good job. I want to thank you again for coming on, of course. And, you know, please give us some of the details again, and also upcoming stuff here. You mentioned, of course, your forthcoming book together with the other author. But is that out? Do you know when that's out due?
Yeah, that will be out in November 2014. And it's we're still debating the final title. But it's basically Proof of Consciousness Outside of the Brain. And it's written by myself and Professor Irvin Laszlo.
Irvin Laszlo.
And that will be published by Inner Traditions next year. I'm also at the moment starting work on a new book, which I'm hoping there's a publisher that's very interested in it, which will be a book on the British playwright and novelist J.B. Priestley, with specific reference to his interest in time, and particularly a series of letters that were sent to him in 1963, where he received around about 3,000 or 4,000 letters from people who all had either precognitive experiences or time slips. And this is an absolute gold mine of information. And I'm hoping that a publisher will pick up on this one.
Yeah, I remember that story, by the way. That's fascinating. Can't wait for you to dig more into that. That's a very interesting case.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I'm hoping for that. And one of my publishers has asked me to consider writing a book on DNA, which I'm considering at the moment for next year as a project as well. So there's a lot on at the moment in terms of just doing the marketing for the two new books, because, of course, The Infinite Mind Field and the Philip K. Dick book both came out within 6 weeks of each other. There's a lot of work to be done on that as well. But again, if anybody's interested, my website is anthonypeake.com. That's Anthony with an H, and it's PEAKE.com. The forum is cheatingtheferryman.com. And again, I'm extremely active on Facebook. But as I say to people, please, you know, I'm not a guru. I'm not anything special. I'm just an ordinary guy, just fascinated by a lot of these subjects. And therefore, my ideas are not set in stone. I'm not trying to prove anything. So in which case, if you have ideas or thoughts or anything you know that counters what I'm saying, that's fine. I want to hear from you. I also want to hear with you if you've had any experiences on the subjects I discuss, from temporal lobe epilepsy to migraine to precognitions to deja vu sensations. They're all grist to my mill. They're all stuff I'm interested in. I really want to hear from you. We have an international community of lots of people, thousands of people from across the world who are now involved in this. Join us. The water's really good.
Good stuff. A Life of Philip K. Dick, The Man Who Remembered the Future. That's the book title. Websites are going to be linked up from ours as well. Well, keep up the good work, Anthony, and thanks again for your time. We'll touch base soon again, and we'll continue our conversation.
Thanks, Henrik. As usual, brilliant talk. Really enjoyed it.
Friends, members, and inquisitive investigators, thank you for listening and for your membership. We'll be back with more in just a few days. We'll keep our programs coming over Christmas as well, by the way. Terry Melanson, Amy Vickers, Patrick Henningsen, James Hall, Randall Carlson, David Talbot, Richard Dewhurst, and many more are coming on. That's just some of our upcoming guests. Keep an eye on redicemembers.com for the latest. And don't forget to subscribe to our RSS feeds for a quick updates. Have a nice rest of your day or evening, wherever you are at, and we'll speak to you in just a few days. Take care.